Across the Pacifica network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, July 3, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Palestinians in Bethlehem talk about this latest supposed handover of power from the Israeli army to the Palestinian Authority. Today's nationwide unemployment figures indicate the worst economy for working people in 9 years. And do your kids take classes in a portable classroom? There's a good chance they do, and there's a good chance they may be suffering from too high formaldehyde levels, a new report says. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The European Union Parliament overturned a de facto 5-year ban on genetically modified food products today and adopted what environmentalists are calling a fair deal, leading to stricter labeling. From Denmark, Patrick Beckett reports.
The European Parliament voted for mandatory labeling of all products sold in Europe containing more than 0.9% GMOs. The decision has been praised by environmental groups such as Greenpeace and European governments who have been upholding a moratorium on most GMO products since 1998. They believe consumer resistance to GMOs will mean that most GMO products will never make it to supermarket shelves. The Parliament also decided to allow each country in Europe to draft their own coexistence laws regulating the protection of organic crops from GMO contamination. The Parliament's decision is in part a reaction to threats from the United States to bring legal action against the moratorium through the WTO. The decision has already been criticized by the biotech industry and the U.S. Trade Representative's Office. They say the expense of labeling only for the European market will be a cost-prohibitive trade barrier. In Copenhagen, I'm Patrick Beckett for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush has called on the military to make preparations for another U.S.-ordered regime change in a foreign country, this time in Liberia. According to reports by the Associated Press and ABC News, Bush has requested the U.S. military commander in Europe, General James Jones, provide the Pentagon with a battle plan if the president were to send troops to the African nation. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has asked the United States to assist with a proposed peacekeeping effort to quell severe civil unrest. Yesterday, Bush reiterated statements that he wants Liberian President Taylor to leave the country. President Bush may be pushing the envelope too far and putting U.S. troops at risk with his tough talk to Iraqi fighters, according to former soldiers now in Congress. Erica Price reports from D.C.
Department of Defense statistics show that at least one U.S. soldier is killed daily. When asked about the threat of militant attacks, President Bush expressed confidence in the U.S. military.
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on. We got the force necessary to deal with the security situation.
Democrats that have served in the military, like moderate Senator Frank Lautenberg, fear that President Bush's overbearing confidence has already led to a growing number of U.S. casualties. According to Lautenberg, one-third of U.S. deaths in the Middle East have occurred since Bush signaled the end of major combat 2 months ago. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Erica Price.
Mega retailer Walmart has adopted a policy banning discrimination based on sexual orientation just 1 week after the landmark Supreme Court decision on sodomy laws. John Hamilton with the Workers Independent News Service has more.
The nation's largest private employer has been battered in recent years by a number of discrimination lawsuits, including a massive gender discrimination case currently pending in California. Walmart's change in policy is likely to hold off future court challenges, and according to Zan McCullough-Lucier of the Pride Foundation, a gay rights group in Seattle, it's the latest sign of a dramatic change in corporate America's attitudes towards gay and lesbian workers. 318 of the companies that make up the Fortune 500 now officially banned discrimination against gays and lesbians, but fewer than 40% of the top 500 currently offer domestic partnership benefits. Walmart is not among them. Indeed, few of the retailer's hourly workers can even afford health insurance. With the Workers Independent News Service, I'm John Hamilton for Free Speech Radio News.
The Federal Communications Commission released the much-anticipated new rules on media ownership, rules that will likely increase the holdings of a few media conglomerates that will control greater audiences. James Cullum files this report from D.C.
The Federal Communications Commission released a 257-page order to loosen limits on media companies' cross-ownership of television and newspaper stations. The FCC's cross-ownership rules allow a television mogul like Rupert Murdoch to buy not only a number of television networks, but also a number of newspaper and radio bureaus in the same city. Rachel Cohen, media analyst for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, says that the general public is embracing media reform and in many cases forcing politicians to cross partisan lines.
I think what's going to make the difference is how much Congress hears from constituents in the next several weeks. Are they going to keep getting calls and letters from people?
Democratic FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein voted against the ownership rules. He says that his office has heard from almost 2 million ordinary citizens who oppose the changes, a groundswell of feedback he has never seen before. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
With the handover of power of Israeli-occupied areas from the Israeli army to the Palestinian Authority underway, many reports are emerging of continued abuses by the IDF. At the Rafah border crossing, several hundred people have been stuck for days, while in Gaza yesterday, shortly after opening a settler access road, the Israeli army shut it down again today, denying access to Palestinians trying to cross. This is Israel's Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz today said that Israel will, quote, have to wait a while, end quote, before handing over more occupied West Bank cities and towns to Palestinian control. This comes on the heels of yesterday's highly publicized Israeli military withdrawal from Bethlehem. Yet as our correspondent in Bethlehem, Awad Dwabez, reports, Palestinian residents of the city say that what occurred yesterday was in fact a redeployment of Israeli troops.
The Israeli army redeployment in the West Bank city of Bethlehem has been perceived by Palestinians as another non-sufficient Israeli step. The Israeli army is still imposing a strict siege on the city itself and all over the Palestinian-occupied territories. Just after the Israeli withdrawal from Bethlehem, the Israeli army restricted its measures on the roadblocks, barring Palestinians from entering or getting out of the city. The mayor of Bethlehem, Hanna Nasser, who this reporter was forced to interview over the phone because of Israeli restriction on movement, said nothing much has changed after the so-called Israeli withdrawal.
This withdrawal was a ceremonial withdrawal. The city is still closed. Nobody is moving outside. Nobody is getting inside from the city. The same restrictions, the same reservations. The only difference is the Palestinian policemen with their blue uniforms that was denied for them since 1.5 years now.
The presumed Israeli withdrawal took place from the city of Bethlehem yesterday and some three other adjacent towns, which were occupied 6 times during the current intifada. Mustafa Barghouthi, head of the Palestinian National Initiative, said the Israeli withdrawal is a minor act and that some other Israeli measures have to be discussed.
There is no withdrawal. It's misleading to say it's a withdrawal. It's only redeployment of Israeli troops from certain parts of the city of Bethlehem and Gaza, which they reoccupied after the 28th of September. Simply they cut big piece of the city and practically attached it to Israel, annexed it to Israel, especially in the area of Rahel Tomb.
The wall, according to Mayor Hanna Nasser, is being constructed in the main road between the city and Jerusalem.
The wall that's going to be built on the main road, which is really dividing Jerusalem from Bethlehem, 8 meters high, 3 kilometers length, to annex Rishon-LeZion to the state of Israel.
Last Tuesday, Palestinian and Israeli prime ministers met in Jerusalem. Both Mahmoud Abbas and Sharon stressed on the implementation of the so-called roadmap for peace. Such meeting and agreements came after a Palestinian ceasefire announced by Palestinian factions for 3 months, including Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Again, according to Mustafa Barghouthi, the ceasefire is a golden opportunity to promote nonviolent resistance. But he expressed pessimism concerning an Israeli commitment and full application of the International Roadmap Peace Plan regarding the freeze of settlements activities in the Palestinian occupied territories.
The ceasefire by itself is a good thing, and still I am very worried that Sharon is going to try his best to undermine this ceasefire, as he did before, through assassinations, through attacks, through invasions. The second most important point is that Israel did not freeze settlement activities as should have been done according to the roadmap. And as long as this does not happen, I wouldn't believe that Israel really wants to implement the roadmap.
On the ground, the Israeli army killed a Palestinian activist in the West Bank city of Tul Kerem last night and restricted the movement of Palestinians by closing the roadblocks installed all over the West Bank. Meanwhile, the Palestinian and Israeli prime ministers are due to meet next week in order to discuss further implementation of the roadmap, a map that is still looking for roads without blocks. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Awad Davis in Ramallah.
And you're listening to Free Speech Radio News. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Please tune in tomorrow for our July 4th Independence Day special, Hacking Democracy, where we take a look at the new digital voting machines across the United States in the lead-up to the 2004 presidential elections. The special will be produced by Jeff Brady. As you go out for your Independence Day hot dog, the unemployment figures released by the government today indicate the worst economy for working people in 9 years. Josh Chaffin has this report from D.C.
At a private nonprofit social assistance agency in central D.C. called Bread for the City, social worker Stacy Wyans mostly serves people with disabilities that make it impossible for them to work. She hands out clothing and food and helps with medical assistance. When the unemployment rate surges like it did in June, Wyans says she can tell because she starts hearing from people who aren't disabled.
Yeah, we get a lot of phone calls and people coming in asking for rental and utility assistance because they've been laid off. They're employable, they have skills, and they just can't find a job and can't keep up with their bills. People who are very independent, who have skills.
And do you have that kind of those kind of resources?
No, we do not have financial resources, and unfortunately not many places in the city do.
What do they do?
I've referred several people to temp agencies and things like that just to try and get them a paycheck somehow, and a lot of people tell me they've been to temp agencies and they're not placing people in jobs because there's just no jobs to be had.
The government reports today that the unemployment rate hit a 9-year high of 6.4% in June as businesses cut jobs for the fifth month in a row. More than 3 million Americans have lost their jobs in the last 3 years.
Right now, people are searching on average for 19 weeks before they find a job. That's average. That's the highest average we've had since 1982, when the unemployment rate was 10%.
Jeffrey Wanger is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute in D.C., a group that's funded in part with union money. He says in spite of record low interest rates, the number of manufacturing jobs has been in decline for 35 consecutive months, and 9 million people are out of work. And Wanger says that doesn't count the people who've given up looking.
A lot of people have left the labor force. There's a lot of people who've chosen to, through whatever means possible, not be in the market right now because it's such a bad labor market. So anyone who could went back to school, got extra training, take care of kids, exited through whatever means they could. So there's a lot of people waiting on the sidelines for this economy to turn around so that they'll re-energize their job search.
The Bush administration's Secretary of Labor, Elaine Chao, says some of those people are now coming back into the unemployment lines, and she uses that phenomenon to explain why the bad numbers jumped this month.
611,000 people who have previously taken themselves out of the workforce have declared themselves now back in the workforce and looking for a job. So that can actually be a very hopeful sign of increased confidence in our economy. I do see things moving in the right direction.
Economists on the left argue the way out of a weak economy is to put spending money into the hands of middle-income working people. But White House spokesman Ari Fleischer says the unemployment rate would have been far higher this month if Congress hadn't approved Bush's $350 billion tax cut, which favors the wealthiest Americans. Fleischer says the tax cuts have created more jobs. The Associated Press reports that despite repeated questions, Fleischer offered no figures to back up that statement. On Wall Street, typically stocks go up on higher unemployment figures, but today in a short session, stocks were down 0.79%. Josh Chaffin in the District of Columbia for Free Speech Radio News.
The National Education Association says that one in three schools nationwide use portable classrooms. In California, about 2 million children take classes in about 80,000 portable classrooms statewide. The Portable Classroom Study, recently released by the California Department of Health and Air Resources Board, indicates that portables are failing to meet indoor air quality standards. The study, the largest of its kind, tested 1,000 classrooms around California. The results confirm earlier, smaller studies by two environmental organizations. Formaldehyde levels are too high. Kelly Ramirez has more.
While the study found that some traditional classrooms have air quality problems, it found that portable classrooms were 10 times more likely than traditional classrooms to exceed the one-hour exposure level for formaldehyde. That means that taking a single one-hour class per day in such a classroom could create health effects. Formaldehyde can cause or aggravate asthma and other respiratory diseases and increase the lifetime risk of cancer. Childhood asthma has reached epidemic proportions in the United States. In California alone, 500,000 children have asthma. Janet Powie, a spokeswoman for the California Air Resources Board, says toxic air in school could be a contributing factor.
It is possible that children that have sensitivity to different types of toxins, such as formaldehyde, for instance, might be experiencing more asthma attacks because of their schooling in portables.
The report said that portable classrooms emit relatively low levels of formaldehyde after 3 to 5 years, but Renee Sharp, a senior analyst with the Environmental Working Group, disagrees with that assessment.
The formaldehyde levels that were found even in the older portable classrooms and even in the traditional classrooms were still quite elevated, especially when you're looking at the chronic level of exposure. All of the classrooms, no matter how old they were, greatly exceeded the level of exposure that's known to cause chronic effects.
Chronic effects are the health effects that arise from repeated exposure over time. Ann Gabler of Berkeley is the mother of 5 children. Her 3rd child spent all of last year in a portable classroom. He did not suffer any apparent ill effects, but Gabler, a registered nurse, was concerned nonetheless about the study's findings.
Well, I think that it's actually pretty horrific that the school district is using these, if that's true. I mean, I understand that they need to use some kind of out-of-building spaces as they're doing the retrofitting for earthquake standards and that kind of thing, but if they're putting the kids in portables that have such poor air quality, it makes me really wonder what we might see as the children are growing up into adults, various health problems that could be associated with this exposure in their youth.
Portable classrooms are cheaper than traditional classrooms. That makes them attractive to cash-strapped school districts. But even wealthier districts use them in an effort to reap the monetary rewards California has given out in recent years for reduced class size. Sharp says part of the problem with the environmental quality of portables stems from the way they are being used.
There was one state official who said that there's nothing more permanent than a portable classroom. These classrooms were originally designed with the idea that they could be shuffled between schools or school districts or leased and sold from 1 year to the next. But in fact, they're pretty much cheap permanent classrooms is really how they're being used. And unfortunately, the design of the portables reflected kind of this earlier notion of they're going to be moved around and they don't have a lot of windows, they don't have very good ventilation, they're really small. Hopefully their design in the future, if we continue to use them, can reflect the idea that they're really pretty much permanent.
Janet Powie of the California Air Resources Board says that changes are already being made.
The schools have started to put in lower formaldehyde, lower emitting surfaces such as wallboard, doors, countertops. They can make those that are low emissions, and that is something that is starting to come into play now that portables are newer and they're demanding that they be lower in formaldehyde levels.
A copy of the Portable Classroom Study is available at the website of the Environmental Working Group, www.ewg.org. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelly Ramirez in Oakland, California.
There are over 33 million recent immigrants in the U.S., often refugees from politically or economically ravaged countries. And in this political climate of equating immigrants with terrorists, times are increasingly difficult. But Minnesotan immigrants from Africa, Asia, and Latin America are coming together to strengthen their public voice and demand respect and dignity from their communities. From St. Paul, Hannah Lewis has this report.
There are over 250,000 immigrants living in Minnesota, and their presence has changed the landscape.
The hamburger and pizza shacks of old now sit between cafes selling Vietnamese noodle soup, corn tamales, and Ethiopian Burberry spice lentil dishes. Besides owning restaurants and other small businesses, immigrants also work in hotels, hospitals, restaurants, meatpacking plants, and cornfields. Undocumented workers alone, about 20% of the immigrant population, contribute an estimated $3.8 billion to the state's economy, according to local research organization ASER. But despite the economic and cultural contributions they make, many immigrants do not feel entirely welcome in Minnesota. That's why about 1,000 marched to the state capitol last Saturday to exercise their freedom of speech in the land of the free.
Thank you for having had the courage to be here today. Many people are here, citizens, immigrants, documented and undocumented, people of faith, people of God, people from Kenya, Somalia, Nigeria, Liberia, Asian, Latino, Anglo. We are here to proclaim the rights of immigrants and to take up the call to action.
Mary Gruber is president of ISAIAH, an interfaith coalition of Minnesota churches that mobilizes immigrant Latino communities to organize for their civil rights. ISAIAH, the Federation of Somali Communities, and other local organizations representing different immigrant groups organized Saturday's march.
We're calling them to get involved in different organizations that are building power to make the changes necessary to make our lives better for all Minnesotans.
Pablo Tapia is the co-chair of ISAIAH's Campaign for the Preservation of Immigrant Families. He explained that after 9/11, the different immigrant groups realized they were up against the same challenges and have since joined forces.
And it's amazing to see that even though we have different religious preferences, different ways of conducting in our society, we still are on the same boat. We know it, and we're going to use our power that unites us in this to make the difference.
Immigrant issues include the separation of families, racial profiling, detentions and deportations, and a painfully slow path to citizenship. One Somali marcher's sign read, "We don't want a life in the shadows." Now these groups are stepping out into public light, waving American flags, donning traditional Aztec clothing, and dancing in the streets, chanting, "Si se puede, ha huacana," or "Yes, we can." At the rally, immigrants were urged to register to vote and to become politically active. Many will participate this fall in the nationally touring Immigrant Worker Freedom Ride. Riders will call on the U.S. Congress and the public to legalize residency for all immigrant workers and to protect their rights on the job, regardless of immigration status. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Hannah Lewis.
The government of India is attempting to evict India's indigenous people from the lands they've lived on for generations. Though historically the indigenous of India were the only tribe to have resisted the centuries-old colonial system, they're never recognized as freedom fighters. Instead, the government's Forest Department is now trying to prove that these people who've been living in their land for generations have trespassed on the jurisdiction of the Forest Department that was formed recently. While the 1992 United Nations Rio de Janeiro Declaration on Environment and Development proclaims that states should recognize and duly support indigenous peoples' identity, culture, and interests, and enable their participation in the achievement of sustainable development, indigenous people in India say that they're at the mercy of the government and large landowners. But as Binu Alex reports from central India, a slow rebellion is building among India's native peoples.
This is more agony than music. The agony of India's indigenous people's lands are now claimed by the government. These indigenous people have been carrying out agricultural activities for centuries together. The Forest Department of the Government of India has now created documents for these lands. But these people have only oral tales about their ownerships, and this song is to unite and fight. A slow but definite rebellion is brewing among these 80 million indigenous people in India, 8% of the second most populous nation in the world, to regain their only asset, land. Dr. Ganesh Devi is a crusader for tribal rights in Gujarat.
Of all the things, the most important for any indigenous person is the land on which she or he is settled. Take away that land, and that's like taking away that person's life. It is their land by natural justice, out of lineage, tradition.
The Forest Department was formed in 1952 to primarily save the forest. But instead, the forest covers that these indigenous people have preserved for centuries have vanished. The department squarely blames the forest dwellers and demands written documents as a proof of ownership. Ganesh Devi is now back with intellectual support for his cause.
So it is not just a conflict of ownership of land, it is a conflict between two civilizations, one given to oral traditions, another believing in written documents.
The United Nations observed that the ability to participate fully in sustainable development practices on the lands they occupy has tended to be limited economically, socially, and historically. The International Labour Organization suggested that governments must consult with indigenous and tribal peoples within their countries on development projects and other activities affecting them. It provided for respect for their land rights, but indigenous landowners like Gobhan Singh has more complaints now.
More than 200 of us have gone before the collector, but they have refused to give us the right to cultivate. The village officer is waiting to be bribed for illegally making entries into the record books.
In India, a number of movements, including Naxalite movements, were all born out of such oppression, and such a movement could break out even before the government could realize it. The main reason for such oppression is also continuous neglect from the mainstream. Very few, like Devi, has made attempt to respect their culture.
An ethnic group which is not politically empowered, which is not economically advantaged, which is not educationally foregrounded, is likely to remain neglected.
But education and awareness is not making inroads into these regions hitherto untouched by development. Oral traditions are going around, asking among themselves to awake and fight for legitimate rights.
We have been uprooted from our culture, family, and society, and the oppressors have made us helpless because of our lack of unity.
From the tribal regions of Central and Western India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Cutter Mesta, Simba Russo, with Aaron Glantz. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Josh Chaffin. Our technical production team is Jade Pageant-Seekins, Pauline Bardalone, and Lindsay Benedict. Web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. We also have technical assistance from our intern, Bob Stern. I'm Deepa Fernandez.